Welcome to the Real Estate Investor Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Lipsky of Break of Day Capital. I talk to leading experts to discuss a wide range of subjects to educate investors on best-in-class practices to build legacy wealth and positively impact communities. Let's jump in. Hey, everyone. We have launched the BODC Multifamily Impact Fund. Invest with a trusted operator with a track record of success. Our fund offers diversification, risk mitigation, tax benefits, and stringent acquisition criteria. If you'd like to learn more, head over to our website at breakofdaycapital.com.
Choosing the right insurance coverage for multifamily properties isn't that complicated, if you know who to talk to. At the Garzella Group, we're uniquely qualified to help you navigate the range of policy choices you have, and we're committed to saving you 30% in the process. We do intensive market research and have nationwide relationships, so we can find coverage other insurance brokers simply can't. We should talk. Go to quotenow.biz, and we'll start the conversation.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Investor Podcast. Today on the podcast, we have Charles Carrillo back with us. He was on episode 49 and talked about foreign investors. Charles is the managing partner of Harborside Partners, a real estate syndication firm, and has been actively investing in multifamily and commercial real estate since 2006. Since then, he has invested in over $200 million worth of real estate. Charles is also the host of the Global Investors Podcast, where he interviews professionals about investing in U.S. real estate. Thanks for joining us, Charles. Can you start by telling the listeners a little bit more about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Gary. It's great to be back. So yes, I grew up in a real estate household. My dad has been a multifamily investor since 1984. So I grew up and my dad owned a lot of D and C minus class properties. So really, really tough asset classes. Not something that you can go out and just get hire a property manager for. So he self-managed them, him and his partner. They had like a small team, but it was like they got to like 100 units before they start selling them off. No syndications, just their own money. And they started selling them off in like the late 90s. And those were very troubling properties. It was something I never wanted anything to do with. But then as you get a little older, you understand that you can invest in the better properties. And that was something my dad was like stressing me. So when I got out of college, 06, I purchased my first property, which was a three family, what we call now a house hack. But I was living in one of the units. I rented out the other two units. And I learned to become a landlord. And then I bought another property like a block away, another three family. That was a true full investment, my first one. And yeah, it was a great learning experience. And since then, got into commercial a little bit after that, like some mixed use properties, and then getting into smaller apartment complexes, and then actually syndicating our first deal. We got involved with syndications in 2018.
Well, I'm jealous that your dad was in real estate and taught you a little bit about it, and you had some lessons learned. My family was, they were doing well, but they never discussed finances, investing, any of that. And certainly I've learned some lessons of what not to do, but man, I wish I had that. I wish I started much earlier and had some basis to start with, you know?
Yeah. It was a great second education growing up.
Absolutely. So what were some of the biggest lessons you learned about that first purchase?
First purchase, I think after I look back on those first couple purchases I made was, I think buying better areas. And even though I bought better areas than, because my dad was always stressing, I'd show him a property for my first property and he didn't invest. He's never invested in any of our properties or anything like this. It was just, I would show him something and he'd be like, no, look for a better area. Look for a better area. You know, I'd find some off-market deals. I bring up to him and he's like, he wouldn't say these are like terrible areas. He would just be like, they're going to require daily upkeep, right? Daily, which is his way of saying, this is a piece of crap, buy something in a better area. It was kind of like his like arm length kind of mentor thing. And, you know, buying properties in better areas. And I found out that when you're buying properties, the difference, even like a block can make where you're buying, it's so super specific. Whereas, and it's also the size of the properties. I found out that if I purchased a property with one extra bedroom, with 150, 200 square feet more, whatever it might be, I could keep tenants in there. I had tenants when I sold that in a portfolio in 2022, all of my properties in Connecticut, where this originally from, where these were. And it was, I could have 10 years versus like 1 or 2 years. And like, you know, when you look back on it, you're getting that, this was low inflation, central Connecticut. There's not much rent growth. There's not much population growth. So you're getting 1% or 2%. I mean, that compounds greatly over many years. But the thing, though, is that it's something where there's no make-ready fees. You know what I mean? You're just going in there. Someone goes in there once in a while, fixes something here, fixes something there. I mean, it's just like you're printing money on those units. So that's what I figured out is when you're buying properties, find out what's most in demand there. You know what I mean? Buying a little bigger units, we found. And that's a huge thing we have now, which making sure that at least 50% of the units we're buying are two bedrooms in what we're buying. You know what I mean? And if you can go big, because that's going to keep people in those properties longer. And that's the whole name to the game. So I think better areas, buying units that fit directly with it. And then also avoiding stuff with like functional obsolescence. These were older properties, but like that's not something you really have to worry about if you're buying 1980 or after. But if you're buying before then, that's when people, you don't have enough parking spaces. You know what I mean? These are things you just can't fix. I can't just like, you know, pave the whole yard and put it. So these are difficult things. And we got around some of them, but it's difficult if you're like up against that in the beginning. And I found it's just much easier when you're getting into those like C+ type properties from even C. Once you get the C+, even into the B-, the whole tenant demographic changes. The whole ease of management changes. So it's really just buy better areas, buy better properties. You're going to pay more for them. It's going to hurt a little bit initially, but you are going to look back on it with those appreciation, which I know we're not supposed to invest for, but we do want the appreciation. We're going to get a mix of appreciation and cash flow in those properties.
That's excellent advice. I think a lot of us, I know me in particular, we were buying some properties that were definitely, I wouldn't say C-, but C. And so, you know, it was tough on our staff too. When you get into that C+, B-, it's a lot easier to keep staff too, because they're not having to deal with such rough, you know, tenants. And that's certainly not everyone, but certainly you inherit a few that, you know, maybe don't belong to be living there. And if you can get them out, then it certainly makes your life easier. You know, one of our properties, we've only had it for 3 years, but the manager for 20 years and the maintenance supervisor for 24 years. And it was just a nice property that, you know, they just stayed at, which made our lives so much easier.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you decide which sponsors, deals, and markets to focus on? Because I know you've had a wide range of experience over a long time.
Yeah. So kind of how our business model works now is I'm based in South Florida, and our three markets that we really focus on now currently are Dallas-Fort Worth, Greater Atlanta, and then what we call here in Florida, it's really the I-4 corridor, which is pretty large, but it's really going from Tampa all the way to Jacksonville. And I can have a larger little scale there because I'm based here. So it makes it a little easier if I'm going to be boots on the ground. But really what we're doing is we're working with three main sponsors in these areas that we can partner with. And I think one of the best things as a limited partner, you can go in and you can do your research on the operator, and you can talk to previous investors, and you can ask questions, and you can watch them from afar before you invest, which is usually how we found it with people investing with us. It's very rare. I've had it on some instances I can think off the top of my head, but usually it's people that you've had a relationship with for a year or plus before they start investing, which makes perfect sense. You know what I mean? They see exactly what you're doing. They get on calls with you. They listen to you on podcasts, or they're meeting you face to face, whatever it might be, doing emails and calls, and you're building that relationship with them. And that's how I've really found it for passively investing, since I do some passive investing as well in real estate, as well as active investing. But I think the easiest part is that if I passively invest with a group, it's going well. Maybe we have an exit from that group. If I want to then say, coming in on maybe a general partner role with them, I already have a extensive many years experience of working with them, literally finances with them. So know exactly how returns are. Pro forma is pro forma. I mean, everything's going to become, you know, it's never going to come out at that. So there's always going to be some hiccups. You're going to have certain things that come in, you know, expenses were a little higher, but our cash flows were a little high. Everything's a little different. And so how they kind of roll with those punches, how fast they get back in touch with me, how, if I have questions, how fast they respond. I mean, these are all important things, because one thing I found with the kind of sponsors is really that as they get bigger, the communication level drops where you're asking. And that's one thing that we make sure when people are reaching out to us, it's going through myself or one of our partners, and it's, you know, it's being handled immediately. And that was one thing is when I would speak to anybody, and that's one of the first questions I ask when I speak to investors. Where have you invested before? If you passively invested, how was that? You know, you don't have to give me names of who you're investing into. Maybe they'll tell me, but it's something that is really like figuring out what do they really want. Everybody has a little difference, but the main thing is that if there's anything that's happening, like with these, you know, like you were saying with interest rates when we were talking beforehand, it's something that you want to communicate all this information on a consistent basis of what's happening, what you're doing about it, and what you foresee for the future. And I think being proactive like that makes it easier. If you're doing it by email, it makes it a lot easier for your investors to, they're not going to be contacting you as much, right? Because you have all that information out there. So it makes it easier for you to manage your investors. But also, it gives everybody an idea that you have everything under control. When you start getting late messages or incomplete messages, that's when there's stuff starts happening. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. We save a lot of time by having really good communication. And, you know, investors don't expect everything to go perfectly, but it's like, okay, how are you fixing that problem? You know, plan A, plan B, plan C, whatever it is, as long as you're taking action and you're communicating those things, an investor is going to be okay. This is running a business. And we had our semi-annual call not too long ago, and all of our properties, there was 8 of them, had different NOI charts and different occupancy charts. Some were, we had 3 in the same submarket and 3 vastly different, you know, charts. So it's not all a straight line up to the right. You know, it's these ebbs and flows, and how you deal with it and how you communicate is so important.
Yes.
So you mentioned a bunch of things, probably already answered it, but I'll dig a little deeper. How do you mitigate risk when investing in real estate?
The easiest way, especially if someone's a first-time investor, and how I'll tell them is that you're getting, you know, the easiest ways of mitigating risk is, number one, is if you're buying in a good area, you're buying a property that needs what we call a light value add, a light lift, which would be something that's a minor renovation, right? Something that's pretty much already rented. The property is already cash flowing with the debt you're getting, and get long-term fixed debt. I mean, if you're putting all these pieces together and you have reserves, it's very, very difficult to lose money on that deal. The problem where people get into is where people that might not have as much experience take on more creative financing approaches, number one, which is where they're getting into variable debt, floating rate debt, very short-term debt. This is where, like, a lot of people, when I speak to people that got killed back in like 08 and 09, we had all like long-term fixed debt, 15, 25, 30-year mortgages on properties. So like there wasn't a problem at that point. The problem happened with people that were like, I have a loan for 1 year. You know what I mean? And I mean, when I speak to people, even if they're flipping properties or if they're getting seller financing, I was speaking to a student of mine and he's like, oh, I was going to do 2 years. Well, try to get that as long as possible. There's no prepayment penalty. You know what I mean? And he's like, well, I want to refinance it. It's like, it's a higher interest rate. Well, you can always refinance it, but you don't know if you're going to be able to. You know what I mean? If you have a great property and you come up at the end of 08 and it's a commercial property, or 09 or 2010, I mean, you need something to bring you to 2011, 2012 when people were actually wanting to invest or finance properties again. So the thing is, like, always have a lot more runway than you really think you need when it comes to the debt. And that's where people really get squeezed. It's these people that were trying to build properties and they're taking very short-term debt and they're just hoping that it was going to work out. And at some point it's going to end. And that's why people get killed in all real estate cycles when it comes down to the end of it, because they're the ones that paid a lot for it. To make the numbers work, they're going this 85 loan to value type thing. I was just reviewing a deal that I was asked to enter in 2021 and we never did. And I'm showing it to some people I know, like just a perspective of what it was. 85% loan to cost. They're saying the interest rate's 3.85%. I mean, just like the first couple lines of their pro forma just shows you that havoc. You know what I mean? And it's like, even at that level, the DSCR, the debt service coverage ratio with all that stuff was like 1.1. I mean, these are just things that are like, I mean, it's just like a little upset there and the whole thing's done, which happened. But you just look at that and you're just like, you look back now, but when you see that, it's just like, it's just extremely risky type of financing. So I think long-term debt, if you're working as a first-time investor, if you're investing passively, you know, it doesn't have to be, there's a lot of prepayment penalties and they're huge. So it's the thing is that whatever the type of debt product they have, you know, the longer term they're going to have on it, the longer the cap on it, whatever their strategy is, and depending on, maybe it's the same thing when you passively invest, find a property, maybe the returns are going to be lower. They're not going to be 20%. Maybe they're 13. But the thing though is that they're putting minimal money into it. They put $1,500 or $2,500 a unit over this 5-year hold. It's going to be a lot less risk, a lot less vacancy, a lot higher occupancy. I mean, you're going to have a better chance of a better outcome.
I've only gotten killed in a couple of real estate deals, and I invested passively in some ground up development and just time killed those deals.
Yeah.
Where it's supposed to be done in 2 years and end up being 5 years or this or that. But you know, there was a lot more risk involved and certainly ground up. Not saying all ground up is bad, but you better have a better risk reward profile for that. What has been some of the most important things to your success in real estate along the way, whether it's a book, a mentor, a partnership, whatever it was, and why?
Having mentors, definitely. These is not something you can learn in school, right? I mean, these are all things that we're learning from other people. We're learning from experience. But having a mentor early on, and they can be paid mentors. They can be people that, no matter how you're getting the information, I think as I got paid mentors, the growth went much higher. And that's in anything. You know what I mean? I had a golf coach years back. My score really improved. You know, whenever you do something and you're one-on-one with something or one-on-one with somebody, or you're in a small group and you're learning with like-minded people, you really can grow fast. And if that's your goal is of time, the essence, I mean, this is this thing where I think having a mentor, there's a number of books out there, there's a number of podcasts. And then obviously the best way is doing it yourself. However, you really want to learn the ropes from a mentor, because when, you know, like, it's one thing, I had one mentor years back that was telling me when we were buying larger multifamily stuff, you know, like still smaller than they weren't syndicatable properties, but they were, you know, larger than three families. You know, you're buying like 10 and 20 unit properties. And they were always telling me, you know, always raise the money for all the repairs and renovations up front, right? You're going to get some money possibly from your JV partner, stuff like this, just like something simple like that. Because back in the days when you didn't have any partners, I was just doing it myself. I could take money from here, take money from there. You know what I mean? How it goes. You're just like getting the deal done. You pull money off the card, whatever it takes. When I didn't have money, like to do it, you know, and you're laughing because it, but it's different when it's not your money. You know what I mean? Or you have other people's money going with it. And like just that simple thing. Now it's just like a no brainer for like the last 10 or 15 years where it's like, this is the only way to do it. The only way to do it is raising that money up front. Cash flow was nice, but it's in the beginning, we are not using that for anything. Maybe like fixing some faucets here or there, but we're not like changing hot water heaters with it. We're not changing HVAC out. We're not changing roofs with this. You know what I mean? So it's like type of lesson you can learn from a mentor and then apply it and save yourself and hopefully your investors tons of headaches and costs along the way.
Absolutely. Mentorship has been great for me, played a role in my success, or and being around like-minded individuals, whether it's through a conference or groups I'm involved in, huge thing. And talking about the cash flow to pay for expenses, yeah, that's, or CapEx, that's a no-go for any investor out there, because God forbid you don't have that cash flow. Now you can't execute on your business plan. Things break. It's not a matter of, you know, if they will break, things will break. It's a matter of when. So have that money. If you don't use it, you can always return it back to your investors, to yourself. Have that ready to go. That's a huge lesson.
Definitely.
Well, Charles, I appreciate you coming on the show and adding your ton of value on all your experiences. Where can listeners find out more about you and your company?
Yeah, thanks, Gary. So if you want to check out our company is harborsidepartners.com. And if you go to harborsidepartners.com, we have a ton of information on there. I have a podcast. Gary's been on a couple of times. He's coming on again. I have a YouTube channel there. We have just tons of information on actively and passively investing in real estate. And if you're interested in signing up for our investor club, you can do so. Get on a call with one of the partners, maybe myself. And then also we have like a bunch of free guides and stuff on there. So tons of free information to learn about how to be an active and passive investor on harborsidepartners.com.
All right. Awesome. Well, this is Gary Lipsky signing off. I'll be back next week with another informative episode on the Real Estate Investor Podcast. To all of our listeners, thanks for joining us. And if you like this episode, please head over to iTunes or Stitcher and like, subscribe, and leave a review, as it will help us reach more people. And if you'd like to learn more about what we do at Break of Day Capital, head over to our website at breakofdaycapital.com and sign up for our newsletter and fill out our investor application. We'll talk to you next week.